And I'm Steve Bertrand. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Welcome to this Saturday afternoon. Nice sunny skies, a little more chilly than you might like, and the snow is just around the corner. We got some snow coming in maybe tomorrow night, but why not? It's springtime now. Look who's here. Matt Heimer is here. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
And well, let me turn your microphone on there. Sorry about that, Matt.
No problem. Glad
and
to be back.
So last time you were here, you were working for someone else.
I was. That's true. I am now a senior editor at Fortune magazine. I had been at MarketWatch previously.
So just one appearance on the Wintrust Business Lunch, and you're moving up the ladder.
That's right. It's clearly been a great career move.
I can't imagine why anyone else would say no.
I need to be in more radio, obviously.
No, this radio. No,
yes,
other radio.
Exactly.
You say no to all other radio.
Oh, of course.
I want to talk a little bit about the food industry, because it's in the news for a couple of ways.
Sure.
And first is Starbucks, because Starbucks fascinates me. I just ran across and got my cup of coffee before the show. They're everywhere. And this guy, Howard Schultz, who, you know, is the CEO and the boss there, has this idea of making a social impact. He did it with gay marriage, right? He's done it with other issues.
Gun control.
Gun control, right? He's saying, don't come in my place with a gun.
That's right.
And now he's got this race issue where he wants his baristas to talk to people about race when they come in. And even on the coffee cups, it's going to say, what, race together on the cups?
Hashtag race together.
Okay, so, you know, guy thinks he's going to help, has a good idea. Man, the backlash has been huge.
I think what's interesting is that some of the backlash has come from people who are known for talking about race. You know, Gwen Ifill, a very prominent African-American journalist and commentator, basically, I think she tweeted something like, really, you're going to try to talk to me about race when I haven't had coffee yet? Are you insane? And, you know, almost all of Schultz's moves along these lines have gotten that kind of reaction. You get this fierce backlash. But I think what he's learned is that the backlash in the media gets people talking about the brand, but it doesn't really seem to hurt business.
Right,
you know?
Right.
The gun control thing, you had a very, very big backlash in rural parts of the country and parts of the South where gun ownership is really just sort of seen as fundamental to the culture. And yet, no blip in sales. You know, you had some protests, you had some things like that, but it passed. And
all right, so read his mind. Is he doing this for sales, or is he doing it out of a sort of a sincere wish to be involved and make things better?
I think he recognizes that his brand and his very successful business gives him this platform, and I think he feels obligated to do something with it. I've talked to some people who have worked in Starbucks who have talked about the fact that in practice, very, very seldom are they actually sort of ordered to be very strict in enforcing these ideas. You know,
right.
I mean, they, you know, so essentially you've got a lot of situations where they're going to their bosses and saying, do I really have to write this on the cup? And the managers are saying, only if you want.
Well, it's an interesting thing, right? Because how do we learn about other races and other situations? Often by being involved with people from of different cultures and different backgrounds, right?
And
we do that in the Starbucks.
That's true. And in fact, in many communities, it might be the case that if you are sort of more affluent and white, you're most likely to run into people who aren't white when they are serving you.
Right.
And the word serving sounds so loaded there, but that is kind of the issue. I think this may be less true in some other parts of the country where there's less racial diversity, but let's face it, more and more communities are diverse, period.
Being affluent and white, it's nice to think you're interacting when you say thank you to the person serving you.
That's right. That's
it's a little more uncomfortable when they say, hey, do you know where I live?
That's a nice way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And would you go to where I live? I think
why don't you come over tonight? Right.
Sure, sure. And I would love to see conversations. There are times when I find myself as a person of whiteness, you know, wishing I could start a conversation like that and thinking, but if anything, I find myself thinking, well, if I'm on the other side of this conversation, who wants to talk about that with me, you know?
Not bad for business, right? The stock is splitting for
stock
the first time in,
that's
what,
right,
10 years or so.
Yeah, and that drove it to a new 52-week high. Also kind of buried by this news, Starbucks just passed Subway as the number two top-selling restaurant chain in America. Now they are number two behind, Starbucks is number two behind McDonald's.
And what does that mean? That's because they're selling more food items?
Well,
or there are more spots?
They're classified as a restaurant because they sell food as well as coffee, but basically, they've expanded quite a bit. I think they still have a goal for another 3,000 locations worldwide over the next year. So they've continued to expand. But yeah, I think per restaurant they sell much less than a McDonald's does.
You know, we've talked about McDonald's here and how they get in trouble because they offer too much.
Mm-hmm.
They're paring down their menu to make their service more quick.
Yes.
Starbucks seems to be offering a lot of different products itself. Is there a risk for them there?
They have stumbled in that area. I think a lot of people consider that their move into the lunch world has not been successful. Nobody really wants a Starbucks sandwich, especially since they're a little on the pricey side.
Right.
But I think Starbucks is more flexible than McDonald's in letting individual store managers decide something doesn't work and then pull it. So that basically, you know, they can send up a trial balloon, but if it doesn't work out, they haven't committed that much in the way of resources. You know, they're not committed to their equivalent of the McRib.
That's because there's not national advertising saying get the McRib at Starbucks?
That's right. Yeah, Starbucks, their advertising strategy is very different, and it doesn't rely as heavily on that kind of national push.
Let's talk minimum wage in a different way. This fascinates me, this idea. Now, you know, everyone knows there's been a fight all over the country, and some more successful than others, about raising the minimum wage. It's basically a state issue now. We're saying the federal minimum wage is kind of stalled. And I'd kind of forgotten about the fact that if you work as a waiter or waitress or in many of these sorts of positions, that you can make sub-minimum wage because the idea is that you get tipped in people, right? And that's why we give tips.
Right.
It's supposed to be for service, but really we think, well, this person's not making even minimum wage. They rely on tips for their salary.
That's right.
Now there's a growing push to get rid of that tippable minimum wage. I think here in Illinois, it's 60% of what the minimum wage is.
Mm-hmm.
There's legislation in Rhode Island where they would get rid of it altogether. I think I read, Matt, that there are seven states in the country where there no longer is this tippable minimum wage.
That's right. One of those states is California, where I just happened to be on a visit to my family. In these states, most of which are on the West Coast, although Minnesota is one of them, but anyway, in these states, basically, you have to pay restaurant workers and servers, the kind of people who would normally get the tippable minimum wage, you have to pay them the actual federal minimum wage, which in many states is twice as high or even more. What's happening is that the restaurants, really, they have to pass these costs on to somebody. Restaurants are not highly profitable businesses. So they're adding, in California, they're adding a lot of surcharges to the bill. You might go into a restaurant there and find that it's more like being in Europe, where a tip of 15 to 20% is included. Often they're striking this kind of weird middle ground. For example, I ate in a restaurant with my parents where there was teeny tiny, you know, like 0.5 font at the bottom of the menu that said they were adding 5% to the bill to comply with local labor laws and minimum wage laws. So that did still leave the discretion to you to give the tip. It wasn't sort of mandatory.
So if they come up to the minimum wage and then they still expect the 20% tip, as a consumer, that's going to be costing me more.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
The alternative would be, I would think, okay, well, they don't need as much of a tip from me, so I'm going to start leaving 10% or 50%, right, would be shamed out of the restaurant. So then, then the waiter or waitress suffers, right?
Yeah, that's true. And I think that what some people in the restaurant business, I should say among the serving staff, are saying is that basically this is going to push Americans to do something they don't really love to do, which is talk more explicitly about money. You know, what a lot of servers are asking is for their employers to be very, very specific about how much money is built into the bill to go to the servers, hoping then that the customers, like you and me, will look at the bill and say, okay, well, I know normally tip 20, but now they're adding 5, so 20 minus 5 is 15, so I will tip 15.
So now we're talking about race in Starbucks, and we're talking about money in every every restaurant
that's
in the country, right?
And
it's very uncomfortable. I don't even like going out.
To do math while we're drunk.
I don't like going out anymore. I'm going to stay home. I'm going to take my Tesla and drive around the country. Not even drive, ride around the country.
That's right. Your Tesla will drive you from one Five Guys Burgers and Fries to another.
Come on, that's not true, is it?
Well, it could be. Here's what just happened. So Elon Musk, who is kind of the James Bond of the corporate world. Everybody, you know, thinks he's so dramatic and sleek. But he was talking this week
about... There's like a cult around that guy.
Yeah, there really is. I mean, people believe him to have, you know, business superpowers. He... this week's Tesla announced an immediate software upgrade that has to do with basically making it so that the driver of a Tesla will always know how far they are from a electric charging station. And so that had been an issue, the keeping some people from buying Teslas, which is that they were afraid they wouldn't know where to go to fuel it up. Personally, the issue keeping me from buying a Tesla is it costs $100,000.
A lot of money.
But anyway, so they released this software update, which addressed that issue. But then they kind of casually mentioned Elon Musk and the company kind of casually mentioned that basically a software upgrade this summer would essentially enable the car to drive itself, to go in this autopilot mode. And of course, you know, the world went crazy and the stock went up and everybody's that much more excited about their electronic Teslas. This is actually, you know, in the luxury car segment, anything from like, you know, your BMWs and Audis on up. There a lot of these electronic, these autopilot driving technologies are already happening, you know, automatic braking, you know, warning you if there's another car anywhere near you, warning you about
cars will park themselves, right?
Yeah, exactly. Some of that technology is already out there. And almost every major car maker is working on this autopilot mode. But interestingly enough, Tesla has so much mystique around its technology and also a track record of delivering a lot of it.
If Elon says it, it must be true.
Exactly. And so in some ways, I'm not surprised that he sort of would iron the bugs out of that most quickly. Of course, the biggest barrier to an actual sort of autopilot car right now is regulation and insurance.
Right.
Nobody really knows what to do if your autopiloted car crashes into somebody or something.
The states are too involved right now with a minimum wage. They can't deal with a driverless car.
That's right.
Matt Heimer, the senior editor for Fortune magazine. I can't wait to see what job you have next time you come back.
Thanks. I'm aiming for a U.S. Senate. Let me know what you think.
That's available. I think that might be up pretty soon. Nice to talk to you again.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, we're going to talk NCAA betting and trouble in the office, fights over the pools, and all of that coming up a little bit later on the Business Lunch. Right now, CJ Jensen is here, CJ the Money Guy, to talk about your retirement and ways to save. And you know, CJ, I was reading that there was a survey this week that said, let me find the number here, it was a T. Rowe Price survey, 53% of parents polled said they would prefer to tap into their retirement savings to help pay their kids' college expenses rather than have their kids take out loans, which, you know, I've got a kid in college and another one getting ready. I think I could kind of understand that. Good idea or bad idea?
It's a very tempting idea because you see a big pool of money out there that you can pull from. But the bad part of it is that you can borrow for children's education, but you really can't borrow to finance your retirement. So it's really much better to leave those dollars in the retirement account and borrow for education. And then you know you can work on paying those education loans back over the course of your remaining working career.
But I can see that, right? Maybe you just said it, but you've got this lump of money. It's like, well, I already have it. You know, I've got more time to work to build up my retirement a little bit later. Why have the kids saddled with a loan? But the fact is, you're probably saddling yourself down the road.
Yeah, you're definitely saddling yourself. And plus, you're giving up that earned income on those dollars that you have put away. So you're probably going to earn more money by having it invested in the market or in different vehicles than what you would pay in interest on a student loan for your child.
How about those funds that you put away for your kids? It was a 529, right? Is that what
it's called? Yeah, 529s.
So is that taxable when you take it out to pay for tuition?
That is not taxable when you take it out for tuition purposes. So long as you're going to some kind of accredited degree program or, you know, trade school or something like that, so long as it's an accredited, you don't pay any income tax on the growth.
Is that just on the growth? But on the what you put in, you do pay an income tax on that?
No. Well, you've already been taxed before you put it in. So you don't, on a federal level, you don't actually receive a tax break for putting money into a 529 plan. In the state of Illinois, though, you do actually get a tax break from putting money into a 529 plan. So you get a little bit of a benefit. So that's one of the reasons that I recommend that clients use their local or their own state's 529 plan is because you get that tax break.
I see. Okay. So when it comes to hurdles and getting ready for retirement, I mean, obviously you should start saving as soon as you can. But one of the things you suggest, which interests me, is make sure you've got the right insurance. What's that about?
Yeah. So insurance, there's a couple of big things that can throw a big wrench into retirement. One of them is if your spouse passes away. You're losing one of your two income streams, and that affects your current lifestyle, but it greatly affects your retirement standards as well. So the surviving spouse would have to work a lot longer in order to retire. The other kind of insurance is long-term care insurance, which, you know, everybody's concerned about what are medical expenses going to be in retirement.
Right. And so you suggest that people buy that? What is it? Because it can be expensive, right?
Long-term care insurance can be, yes, it can be very expensive. And you want to make sure that you're sized, you size the policy appropriately.
Here's what we'll do. I'll pay for my kids' college, but I'll stick them with my long-term health care bills. Maybe not such a good trade. Can you help people with this if they've got more questions?
I definitely can help them with that. And one of the things with long-term care is it's a supplement. Don't think of it as the one and only source in retirement because people buy policies that may be way too big. So anyhow, yes, I can definitely help them with that.
How do people get a hold of you?
So they can go ahead and call my office. It's 312-546-6070.
CJ Jensen, CJ the Money Guy. Nice to see you again.
Yes, it's good seeing you.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, UCLA is playing UAB the last day of the second. I guess it's the third round now. The NCAA tournament is underway. How much work did you get done on Thursday or Friday? Were you one of those? You know, my wife went downtown. She works generally out of the house, but her office is downtown. So she went downtown on Thursday for other reasons, and she sees that in the conference room they've got pizza set up, and she thought there was some sort of meeting going on that she wasn't allowed to participate in, although the pizza looked good. And come to find out, the office set that up for the NCAA tournament because they knew people are going to be wanting to watch anyway. So, you know, why not go with it? That a good idea? Philip Weiss is here. He is with Seyforth Shaw at Work, the managing director. Philip, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be here.
All right. So how about it? Is that a good idea for the company to do?
Well, it's actually probably one of the safer strategies available to companies. Though there's a lot of risk no matter what when you're dealing with March Madness. There's at least three federal laws that apply.
All right, now I'm reading about the things you're putting out there, and you're talking a lot about this is supposed to be fun, and you're writing about a lot of trouble that could come from it.
Yeah, you know, it could be a little trouble. It could be a lot of trouble. And the fact is, for employers to ignore the risk, that's foolhardy. But at the same time, they can direct their employees and they can sort of direct the waters. I mean, the stream is going to move in one direction.
It's going to happen.
Right. But you can direct the waters a little bit and create some better practices for your employees.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, and I'm no manager, but this is a great way to build goodwill and camaraderie and all of that in the office place.
It is. And frankly, those employers who just tried to internally outlaw March Madness pools, they haven't had a great deal of success.
Right.
But those companies who have managed the process, and by the way, allowing people to watch in the workplace during designated times like lunch, as your wife saw, or a break.
Well, there was an eight-hour lunch. Let me tell you that right now.
I can't advise that. I can't support that. But really, that could be better, Steve, than encouraging people to go off-site.
Okay, but you do write about the idea of losing productivity. And, yeah. You know, a lot of small businesses are running on short margins, small margins. So they need as much productivity as they can get. But doesn't a happy worker lead to more productivity down the road?
Yeah, a happy worker does. At the same time, a worker that gets so involved and engaged in March Madness that he or she is neglecting his or her work, that's a recipe for a whole host of problems.
Okay, let's talk about danger then.
All right.
Fist fights in the workplace?
That's why I'm here. they've happened. We trained an art supply company, and I can't mention the name, but with their permission, the story's fine. And they started using the art supplies to paint first mascots, slogans, and then they used stencils and did it on each other's cars with spray paint.
Oh my God, really?
And some of it got a little inappropriate. That's as far as I can share with you, but you can imagine when people get that involved, problems will ensue.
Okay, but these are probably people who didn't like each other from the start.
Well, you'd think so.
Right?
And you'd think so. In some cases, yes. But in other cases, it's just the absolute loyalty and fanaticism. Because, you know, fan equals fanatic.
Right.
It's that fanaticism about a team. And it is the high stakes nature of betting. That's sort of that's a difficult combination to manage at times.
All right. So you're my boss. And I'm going to come to you. And I'm going to say, you know, Philip, I want to set up an office pool. The guys are going to like it. The girls are going to like it. You know, the girl across the way, she's a huge Illini fan. Okay, she's disappointed this year. But, you know, let's just do it. It'll be a great time. What's your answer to that?
Yeah, well, if I'm a manager and someone comes to me, I'm actually going to take that question and go directly to human resources or to the owner of the company if it's a small company. Because a manager, him or herself, making decisions about gambling in the workplace, that's an individual risk they're taking on themselves. Companies, they should be making the decisions.
Okay, but I know that you've got everyone's best interest at mind, but you know, it doesn't, you know what it sounds like.
Yeah, I do. But I'll tell you this. We had a client where the manager not only gave permission, but he championed the March Madness betting. He opened every meeting with the bracket moment. What happened though, Steve, is 2 weeks later, one of his employees was no longer doing any real work. And when this manager tried to manage that employee, the employee's response, understandably, was, this was your idea. You encouraged me. So managers have got to understand they don't want to buy into the point that they can no longer manage their people.
Okay, so the Thursday and the Friday are behind us.
Yeah.
It's going to be lesser of an issue now. What do you suggest to bosses coming up on Monday?
Yeah, a couple things. Number one, I think it's important that you make sure that madness has not overtaken the office already. And if it has, talk to your managers about reminding people of their work obligations. Secondly, it's important that managers be ready to respond if someone comes forward. And we've seen this in the last several days with a number of companies that have come to us. If employees complain to them.
They're uncomfortable with gambling.
Yeah, religious reasons, moral reasons. We actually had a manager at a company. Again, I can't mention the name, but the manager...
I'll give you $5. Give me the name.
I know that kind of money doesn't count in the world of March Madness, Steve. But I'll tell you this. The manager actually put the money in on behalf of the employee who did not want to ante up or ante in.
Right, right.
Thinking the employee couldn't afford it.
Trying to be nice.
Right. It was a religious issue, a religious concern. That employee's name was all over the bracket sheets, all over the office. So managers don't realize having a response to someone who comes forward is critical, but companies have got to give them that kind of language.
It's where we are these days, I guess, right?
Absolutely.
Philip Weiss from Seifert Shaw at Work. How did I do on that?
That was perfect.
Managing director, it's nice to talk to you.
Pleasure, thank you.
You know, I like to introduce you all to authors from time to time. One of the things I enjoy doing most is interviewing writers. And so we've got longer interviews at WGNradio.com, WGNplus.com as well. But I want to introduce you to Boris Fishman today. He wrote a book called A Replacement Life. It's the story of immigrant Jews in New York. In many ways, though, it's a story that can apply to all of us. And in fact, much of the book is set in Midwood, which is a neighborhood in Brooklyn where that Orthodox family, the terrible fire earlier today where 7 people were killed, it's in Midwood. He writes about that neighborhood. In A Replacement Life, Slava is determined to Americanize himself. He's a young writer. He wants to distance himself from his Russian parents and his grandparents. But after his grandmother dies, he fills in the blanks of her life by creating a fiction around her.
That's right. What happens in the novel is his grandmother is a Holocaust survivor, and Slava is vaguely aware that she went through some really dramatic stuff that he ought to know as her descendant. But like many survivors, she's not eager to talk about what happened. She just prefers to put it all behind. Slava, like many of us, means one day to really sit her down and press, and then she dies. And she dies just as she's become eligible to apply for the restitution that the German government has been paying to Holocaust survivors since the 1950s. And so Slava comes to realize that because his grandfather, who was evacuated to safety, pressures him to write a claim anyway.
Right. So his grandmother's not eligible, obviously. She's not living.
That's right.
His grandfather, sort of a rascal, says, well, write one for me.
And Slava tries to object in this sort of high-minded American way that he's trying to adopt as someone who's trying to assimilate. And he says, but you were evacuated. And his grandfather says, you're a writer, aren't you? And Slava initially wants to resist, but then he comes to see in these forged claims an opportunity to invent a grandmother that he never got to know in real life. And so it's this idea that even if a certain opportunity to enrich one's life is no, however that's defined, is no longer available in nonfiction, in the facts, in real life, that doesn't mean that there isn't a kind of liberation awaiting us in the world of fiction.
That's Boris Fishman, the name of his book, A Replacement Life. You can hear the full interview at WGNradio.com or WGNplus.com. Also on Facebook, on my page at Steve Bertrand on Books, or follow me on Twitter, please, at Steve Bertrand. All right, we're going to take a break, come back with the traffic hotspots, and then an app that will allow you to track your kids at college if they blow off a class. Should you know about it? That's coming up on the Wintrust Business Lunch. King John Williams just around the corner here on 720 WGN. All right, so you're shelling out money for your kid to go to college. Should you know every time they skip a class? Rick Worley, the CEO of Core Principle, says yes, and he says it's not just about the money. Rick, welcome to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. I'm sorry, Jeff.
Yes, thank you very much for having me, Jeff Worley.
I don't know why I wrote down Rick, Jeff, but do you mind if I call you Rick? It'd make me more comfortable.
Rick, it's fine. If we can have the conversation on this topic, I'm good with Rick.
All right, so tell me about Class 120. What is this about?
Well, there's a big problem in this country that even I think pretty well informed people to some degree are missing, and that is the average college freshman entering a 4-year institution today. There's a 50% chance that that student will graduate within 4 years. So the 50% of the students entering today as freshmen will not graduate in 4 years.
Which isn't good. If you're putting your money down with the idea that it's a 4-year investment, that's not good news.
Right. And 40 to 45%, the National Clearinghouse study that the Lumina Foundation just sponsored, says 40 to 45% won't have a degree in 6 years. And so you step back and go, that's really unacceptable. It's unacceptable to the economy, and it's unacceptable waste of money at a family level, at an institution level, at a taxpayer level, because taxpayers are funding a huge percentage of that education.
Okay, so what is my knowing that my daughter blew off her introduction to communications class, how does that change that? What does it have to do with it?
Well, the best studies indicate that the strongest correlation between success in college is to class attendance. More than how smart you are, more than how much you study, how well you study, your ACT or SAT scores. Going to class is the strongest correlation. So when you have a real problem with graduation rates, with retention, with progress from year to year, progress toward graduation, and you're trying to figure out what can we do to improve that, there's a model out there for all of us right now, and it's Division I athletics. Division I scholarship athletes graduate between 84 to 88% each year in 4 years. That's 30, 40% higher than the average student.
All right, I'm going to go ahead.
The biggest thing they do is monitor class attendance.
I'm going to challenge you on two things then, okay? One is that, sure, kids who go to class tend to graduate more often, but those are because they're interested in it, right? It's not just their attendance. They wanted to succeed, so they go to class. So, you know, that's kind of a tough statistic. And then the other thing is, here we are in the middle of the NCAA tournament. Do you think all those college grads who are playing basketball this weekend are earning their degrees?
There's a list of schools. The school in my neighborhood, Butler, is one of those that have 100% graduation rate, and it is a fairly high percentage of the participants.
Any chance tonight against Notre Dame?
Yes.
I think so too.
A chance? Yeah, absolutely. So that is the most insightful question, and I don't get it very often. Is the relationship self-selection? That is the single best question to ask about this point about the correlation. But I would say that if you look at what the athletic departments do, and of course there's horror stories of, you know, this or that athletic department that did basket weaving or whatever, but generally they do very well. And those students, those scholarship athletes, do not come to college with a better academic background. They don't come with more engaged parents. They don't come with better study skills. Yes, my nephew was one of them. They are forced to go to class, that it's monitored and measured, but it does produce a better outcome. So they are not self-selecting students, yet they end up with an outcome, which is what we wish we had for all students.
Right, and I'm giving you a hard time on this, and I don't really mean to, because I think it's
a great question, but I think scholarship athletes prove that it's not just this sort of causal self-selection.
So with those two questions I asked, I sort of proved your point then, because even though they might not be inclined to go to class, if they're forced to go to class, they're going to benefit from it and be more likely to graduate.
Absolutely, they do.
Okay, so we've got this app, and the app is, say I buy it for my daughter in college, you map out the schools, right? You've got 2,000 universities mapped out, and it's a GPS thing.
Yeah, we've mapped over 3,000. Over 2,300 schools right now. It is tedious. It's taken us about 20 months to get them, and we have three people. That's all they do every day is geo map the campuses. And you could, with your daughter's consent, if you around the kitchen table decided, look, you're on academic probation for your first semester of freshman year at Ball State. If we're going to pay for you going back, we want to make sure that you go to class, because clearly class attendance, Susie, was part of the problem in your first semester. Then that's a great choice, and we are very confident that Susie's academic outcomes will improve dramatically. That's not saying it's for every student. It's not saying it's for every school or every class. But for many parents, of these parents who are in that 50% whose students are not, whose sons or daughters are not making it to the finish line in 4 years or even in 6 years, they're home living in the basement, working retail, thinking about when they're going to try college again. That's traumatic. It's thousands of dollars wasted for that family. And a little bit of extra effort in going to class, we think, changes that outcome dramatically.
All right, Jeff, you're a businessman. This is a startup, and we talk about business here. It seems to me that the money for you is less in parents than it is in actual universities, right? Are you going to try to sell this to schools? Tell me about Lynn University.
Our business plan had signing up a full university being in year three of the plan, and it was the first thing that happened, so that was nice. There are three markets for this product. One is universities like Lynn, who've already decided that this correlation between class attendance and student success means they want to have a policy. And what Class 120 does is make it much easier on the professors in terms of taking attendance.
So the idea is for a school, for a university, then they see who's not going to class. And it's in their interest to keep their customers, really. It's in their interest to keep them. So they intervene and say, hey, we need you to go to these classes. We need you to stay in school.
Right. But here's the other aspect that most people don't understand about this. We've interviewed hundreds of dropouts. A dropout can happen in 2 or 3 days. Someone breaks up with a girlfriend, or they have a professor that really gets them sideways, or they flunk a test, or they don't get the fraternity bid that they want, whatever the reason is. Let's say they stop going to class for 3 days. That student is out on the precipice there, on the edge of the cliff, to blowing up a whole semester, which blows up their entire college career. It doesn't happen over a month. It happens very quickly. And what Lynn has said, they want to be the best in the country at knowing when young Jeff has skipped 3 days in a row, so it doesn't get to be 3 weeks.
That's Jeff.
In most schools, it's 2 or 3 weeks before they know.
That's Jeff Worley, the CEO of Core Principal. We're talking about his app, his program, Class 120. It's time for us to fly here, but how do people get more information? How do they get a hold of it?
Class120.com, everything is explained there. You can get in touch with me, and if anyone wants to talk about their situation and their family, I, Jeff Worley, am more than happy to get on the phone and talk to them about it. It's a very frustrating thing for both institutions and families, this graduation rate problem. For $18 a month, we will change any student's chance of graduating on time dramatically. We think that the research is there. Class120.com. You can reach us there, and I'd be happy to talk with anyone of your listeners.
All right, Jeff, thanks very much. We're going to take a break and
come
back and talk to the biggest Butler Bulldog fan in the world. Bye-bye. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.